just a couple of words, I'm Stefan Kipfer, I'll speak second. Just a couple of words about the ideas behind the panel. Broadly speaking, what we're trying to do here is to look at the far right and neo-fascism, both in transnational context and in historical context. Something that I think is certainly central today, given the global character of the far right and neo-fascist conjuncture today. I think the Brazilian election has reminded us of that fact. It has also reminded us of needing to analyze particular manifestations of the far right also in long, not just conjunctural, but also long historical context. So that's the idea behind the panel. We'll have three contributions from that speak to different experiences in different parts of the world. I should also say that the coherence between the papers is not theorized, but the three of us have worked together on various issues before, so you may notice this at some point as we go along. So, Kanishka.
Okay, thank you. So Sri Lanka has been in the news recently. You know, Lonely Planet chose Sri Lanka as the top destination for tourists in the coming year. And there's also a kind of a political crisis going on there right now.
Yeah.
But I will resist the temptation to give you travel advice and comment on the current affairs, but stick to my abstract. And as I promised, my presentation deals with the nature of singular Buddhist nationalism in Sri Lanka, with a focus on the last four decades and with special attention to one particularly instructive and influential ideologue of so-called national ideology in Sri Lanka. The purpose of my brief presentation on this topic is to outline some similarities between Sinhala Buddhist nationalism and some other populisms or even fascisms, while also noting the peculiarities of majoritarian nationalism in Sri Lanka with reference to some post-colonial theory and history. Sri Lanka is home to several ethnic groups, including a Sinhala majority and Tamil and a Muslim minority. And a new development of the national ideology in Sri Lanka over the last 10 years has been the rise of a virulent Islamophobia, including several attacks on Muslims carried out by violent gangs of Sinhala Buddhists. Tensions have been brewing between the majority Sinhala community and the Muslim minority, especially since the bloody conclusion of the Sri Lankan state's war against the Tamil separatist militant group Tigers in 2009. And the latest rounds of terror directed at Muslims remind me of the notorious anti-Tamil pogroms of 1977 and 1983, which I witnessed as a Sinhala-speaking teenager in the streets of Colombo, at the beginning of a 25-year disastrous ethnic conflict in the country. So in reaction to what happened this spring, a few friends and I, academics of Sri Lankan origin, who happen to be living outside now, wrote a letter to a Sri Lankan newspaper condemning both the latest outbreak of communal violence and the failure of the government to deal with it. The very next day, the same newspaper carried a swift response to our letter, written by a Sri Lankan entity called the National University Teachers Association, NUTA. They dismissed us foreign academics for being biased, mostly because we failed to mention the many injustices suffered by the majority Sri Lankan community of Sinhala Buddhists at the hands of Tamil terrorists, Muslim merchants, and Western imperialists. As NUTA signed off the rejoinder, they signed off the rejoinder with a patriotic invitation, stop criticizing Sri Lanka from abroad and return home to serve our motherland. In spite of its official sounding name, NUTA does not represent university teachers of Sri Lanka, but as a small group of aggressively Sinhala Buddhist academics, they do represent a potent ideology. the presently hegemonic majoritarian nationalist ideology that emboldened and legitimated those who were responsible for the recent attacks on the Muslims. It is the ideology of Sinhala Buddhist nationalism, also known in Sinhala as Jatika Chintana, national ideology, which can, and according to its most sophisticated ideologues, this national ideology must be distinguished from ethno-nationalism, which they see as a modern invention imported to Ceylon by colonialism, very much against the grain of this island nation's multi-ethnic and bilingual history of communal coexistence. The nation included the Sinhala majority along with the Tamil, Muslim, and other minority groups, with its Buddhist state forming the backbone of a shared civilization that persisted through at least 2,000 years. Not without controversy, this civilization is labeled Sinhala Buddhist because even non-Sinhala Buddhists of the country were fundamentally shaped by the shared national culture and ethos of the said civilization. The reality of this nation form, of course, doesn't always follow its theoretical ideal. Just before persecuting Muslims, the main accomplishment of Jatika Chintana was the provision of ideological support for a military rather than political solution to the Sri Lankan ethnic conflict, especially since the mid-1980s, just as the Tamil Tigers assumed undisputed control in the predominantly Tamil areas of Sri Lanka, having effectively eliminated rival militant Tamil groups and also ejected Muslims from their jurisdiction. It is the so-called post-war period after 2009 that Sinhala Buddhist nationalism found in the figure of the Muslim its new enemy. What I wish to discuss here is the popular appeal of this national ideology. In order to understand it as an ideology rather than dismissing it too hastily, the modern origins of this national ideology can be traced to the late colonial era of Ceylon under British rule, largely as a response to its divide and rule policy, which was denounced by Sinhala elites aspiring to post-colonial political power for over-representing the minorities in the colonial regime. The leading forms of opposition to British colonialism in Ceylon were thus compromised from the outset by strategically accentuated ethnic divisions within the colony of Ceylon. Instead of becoming a united political force, anti-colonial aspirations in Ceylon were always channeled through two main ethno-nationalist streams, Sinhala and Tamil. Each tended to weave the other within the island and in the subcontinental geopolitical context, more as rivals than allies, with disastrous post-colonial consequences that are still unfolding. So post-colonial Sri Lanka indeed offers a fine case study of what Franz Fanon famously called the pitfalls of national consciousness in the Richard of the Earth. Fanon warned prophetically that national consciousness alone could not achieve the radical emancipatory objectives of anti-colonial struggle. In the absence of a socialist transformation of social relations, both within and beyond the post-colony. But if nationalism without socialism represented a grave danger for Fanon, he also asserted, with theorists of negritude such as Leopold Senghor and Aimé Césaire, the inability of a purely abstract universalist conception of socialism to serve as the immediate or unmediated political antidote to colonialism and imperialism. Negritude was denounced as a petty bourgeois deviation, even reverse racism, by some textbook Marxists of the European left. Jean-Paul Sartre, however, defended Fanon and others for their advocacy of negritude as a necessary moment in the historical dialectic of anti-colonialism, striving for socialist universalism. In pop Hegelian language, we can put it like this: there was first the thesis of European colonialism and imperialism, and second, the antithesis of pan-African negritude or pan-Arab conceptions of national consciousness. But Fanon also envisioned a universal moment of synthesis, a socialist and internationalist humanism in precise opposition to the forgery of European liberal humanism that was fatally tainted by colonialism and neocolonialism. Symptomatically lacking in much post-colonial politics as well as post-colonial theory is this third synthetic moment of the anti-colonial dialectic, the socialist universal aspiration of revolutionary national liberation movements. Single Buddhist nationalism in Sri Lanka is no exception to this trend. The failure to negotiate the relationship between nationalism and socialism in an emancipatory direction. In the first two or even three decades after decolonization, the dialectical project of national liberation and socialist internationalism retained a great attraction for many newly independent countries, as evidenced in such international forums as the Non-Aligned Movement and the more radical Tricontinental, founded in Havana in 1966. Under the auspices of the developmental state in the Cold War, countries such as Cuba, Vietnam, Tanzania represented the ideal, if not always the reality, of a new socialist internationalism summoned by national liberation struggles. The emergence of the conjuncture of neoliberalism between the global recession of 1973 and the fall of the Soviet Union, however, radically altered all that and unhinged nationalism from socialism, giving birth to mutant reincarnations of national socialism. This was a world quite different from the one that C.L.R. James or Walter Rodney imagined and desired. Its ruling political feature was, and still is, the attempt to eliminate socialism as a viable option for the damned of the earth. The watershed moment for Sri Lanka in this story was 1977. The election of J.R. Jayawardene's right-wing United National Party regime, which promptly unleashed the so-called open economy on the island, even before the term neoliberalism had entered popular discourse. This upheaval also involved the defeat of the old left as an electoral force and the deepening of economic disparities as well as ethnic conflict, as demonstrated by the spectacular rise of extra-parliamentary militant forces in the 1980s, especially the People's Liberation Front in the single-dominated areas and the Tamil Tigers in the north and east, along with an alarming escalation of state repression. The repressive force of the state was first used to crush resistance to neoliberalization, most notably in the violent breakup of the island-wide general strike of 1980. Anticipating what Reagan did to air traffic controllers in 82 and Thatcher to the miners in 84. These developments were also accompanied by what I call, following Henri Lefebvre and Frank Fuchs' critics, a radical transformation of everyday life on the island. Most visibly, in southern cities, where urban life itself was rapidly colonized by reform, as an influx of private cars, household appliances, and new color televisions began advertising daydreams of capitalist country consumerism, especially to the subaltern classes who could not so easily afford the promised luxuries. The progressive intelligentsia in Sri Lanka responded in spirited fashion to this new conjuncture. Neoliberalism in the economic domain, authoritarian statism in the political sphere, and Western colonization in the cultural realm. There were soul-searching reflections on the onslaught of commodities, the relevance of Marxism, and the prospects of humane development. One groundbreaking intervention here was a book published in 1980 by entitled Is Anagarika Dharmapala Marxist? By Gunadasa Amarasekara, an essay on the founding father of Sinhala Buddhist nationalism, written by the leading Sinhala writer and public intellectual even today. According to this writer, Amarasekara, this book pursued two objectives. The first was to underline the actuality of the thought of Dharmapala, the founding father of Sinhala Buddhist nationalism, who in Amarasekara's considered opinion was the only serious anti-colonial thinker in Ceylon who properly understood Sinhala Buddhist culture of the island as an indispensable resource for its anti-colonial struggle and post-colonial development. The second intent of the book was to promote a cohabitation, that's my translation of this singular term, a cohabitation between the Sinhala Buddhist nationalist ideology, first articulated by Dharmapala, and the Marxist political movement of Sri Lanka. 8 years later, in 1988, Amarasekara published another landmark text, In the Heart of Darkness, I See the Rays of Dawn. It was in this collection of essays that he spelled out the term Jatika Chintane, or national ideology, as the necessary cultural ideological response to the political economic crisis of the country, at a time when the Sri Lankan state was embattled in a war with Tamil Tigers on one side and the People's Liberation Front on the other, while advancing the neoliberal open economy wherever it could, according to the Washington Consensus. Here, Amarasekara speaks glowingly of a Buddhist civilizational state based on impressive agrarian infrastructure and communal social relations, reminiscent of Marx's sketch of the Asiatic mode of production, one that governed Sri Lanka for over 2,000 years until European colonization. Its salient features included communal ownership, mutual aid, and caring for nature. So a combination of Marx, Kropotkin, and Andreas Mann. So what's not to like about it, you know? As such, the state was the ideal political shell for Buddhist values, just as for Lenin, the liberal democratic state provided the ideal political shell for the capitalist economy. In National Ideology or National Economy, another book written in 1993, Amarasekara developed some implications of his thinking. He said, you know, before choosing a path of development, we must have a clear understanding of its objectives and goals. What is the knowledge that gives us this understanding? This knowledge is contained within nothing else but within our national culture, or to be more precise, within the Jatika Chintane, or national ideology, which can be considered both the expression and the vehicle of that culture. And then he goes on to outline where we can actually get a sense of what this national ideology is. And by saying, we must find in the present some basic outlines of a national economy that's hidden from us and has thus far failed to command our due attention. To this end, we are urged to follow the example of the Dharmapala, the founding father of single Buddhist nationalism, who is said to have discovered this Jatika Chintana, not from any academic study of history or politics, but by virtue of his legendary travels as a 22-year-old in the in the 1880s, through poor villages of British Ceylon. In these journeys, I'm quoting, Dharmapala saw something more important than the poverty of the villagers. That important thing was the residual but live form of our national economy still found in our villages, the village agricultural economy that nourishes village life. So it must be clear to you that our Jatika Chintane is revealed not by some dead past or lost glory, but rather on the basis of a dynamic present, a live socio-economy. The village-based agricultural economy must be termed the basis of our national ideology and economy. So I have 2 more minutes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So instead of reading the rest of it, I will just talk a little bit about the images that I have here. So what I want to highlight here is the spatial and aesthetic element, you know, to this articulation of this national ideology, a certain kind of valorization of the countryside, village life, and so on. But what is really interesting is how this kind of discourse immediately, you know, in the present context, translates into a virulent, you know, and violent nationalism. So this is expressed, for example, by the bumper sticker image, you know, that you, it's a very common thing that you find on 3 tuk-tuks and, you know, taxis and so on in Sri Lanka. The text below the lion represents the singular people. And the text simply says Singhale, you know, which means like the place of the singular people, or, you know, it's like a pure descriptive term. But the last letter is highlighted in red, right? And red alone, le, the red syllable means blood. So it's the blood of the singular people, you know. So that's this. So this is the transition, you know, from the beautiful village, the temple, the tank, and all that. You know, that is where the ideology slide, what it slides into in this kind of discourse. And finally, the evolution of this discourse is also seen in this. You know, if you compare the first edition and the last edition of this book, you know, it's Anagarika Dharmapala, Marxist. So in 1980, there's an image of Dharmapala and Marx, you know, is pretty big, right, compared to Dharmapala. But in the latest edition of the book, you know, you have Dharmapala alone in the middle, you know, mediating between tradition and modernity, you know, sort of interesting way, and Marx is completely gone from it, right? So I have a few more things to say, but maybe we can come to that in the discussion. But I will leave you with a kind of a question. You know, I mean, it's so what happens to Marx here? This is easy to fix on PowerPoint, you know, but in real politics, what to do is the question. I had a few more thoughts, but I'll leave you with Stefan for now.
Right, Stefan Kipfer.
Thank you very much. All right, so I will be talking indeed about dilemmas of historical anti-fascism with respect to a more conventional figure in a conventional part of the world, Henri Lefebvre, and the national questions in the 1930s, in Europe, but also in the context of the French Empire. Let me start with a quote to set the agenda. I should say that this talk is part of a broader project on the meaning of anti-fascism, both historically and since the 1980s, in a transnational context, but with specific focus on Francophone discussions. So here is a quote attributed to Frantz Fanon from an anonymous text published in 1958 in El Mujahid. Here is what Fanon was supposed to have said. Fascism and colonialism are intrinsically linked. The Algerian Revolution and democracy in France should rediscover that they are natural counterparts. At the very moment when liberties are threatened in France, when fascism knocks at the door of the Republic, the struggle of French people for peace in Algeria should resume its course and be resolute in its support for a revolutionary path. Democracy in France depends on peace and independence in Algeria. Fanon reminds us here of two things. One is the colonial articulation of fascism in the French Empire at that time, which was central to the resurgence of European fascism in that period, not just French fascism. He also reminds us of the legacies, political legacies, that have tried to articulate an anti-fascism to an anti-colonialism, something, of course, which takes us back to the 1930s. This quote, to some extent, reflects my point of reference, both for my assessment of Henri Lefebvre's writing in the 1930s, but also debates about contemporary strategies against the far right. So, a few intellectual contexts about historical fascism and anti-fascism in Europe and North America. Some of them are of great relevance to understand Lefebvre's writing in the 30s. The first one are debates about consent. To what extent did historical fascism in those contexts in the 1930s draw upon popular consent? Other debates raging over the last 10, 15 years have to do with scale, the multi-scale or character of fascism, specifically the international character of fascism even at that time, something that Lefebvre wrote about in the 1930s in a particular kind of way, as we will see. With respect to anti-fascism, similar debates have been going on over the last generation, at least, about the international dimensions of anti-fascism in various parts of the world. These debates, of course, come after much longer debates about the nationalization in quotation marks, of anti-fascism in the 1930s. The nationalization of anti-fascist politics, driven at the time, of course, predominantly by the Stalinist Communist International, leading to the decline of anti-imperialism towards the end of the 1930s, and in a contradictory way, also giving stimulus to the rise of national liberation politics in various parts of the world. All of these debates have had a particular condensed version in relationship to discussions about the French Popular Front government and its relationship or non-relationship to an anti-colonial anti-fascism at that period. In the following, I will be making reference to a number of key texts.
Is this showing up? Yeah, somehow. Okay.
By Henri Lefebvre. His writings about mystification with Norbert Drumann from 1933 and 1936. His monographs on nationalism and Hitler. And his autobiographical reflections on that period in his post-party communist book, La Somme et le Reste, from 1959. A few reminders, perhaps, about Henri Lefebvre's work in the 1930s to set a more specific context. From the late 1920s, Lefebvre is working on the early Marx, Hegel, and Lenin, with specific attention to alienation, materialism, totality, and the dialectic, themes that established essentially the problematic of everyday life in his work already in the 1930s, a problematic that will be the most important aspect of his work until his death in 1991. These kinds of engagements by Lefebvre also highlight the tension-ridden relationship that Lefebvre had to the Communist Party of France, which he joined in 1928, and which he repeatedly defended, sometimes even in sectarian ways, in the late 30s and 40s in particular. But that relationship was, in some respects, filled with tension in a number of respects, and we'll see why today, but with respect to his writing about nationalism and fascism. More specifically, his writing about these questions was informed by his trips to Germany in 1932, so before Hitler, and in 1935, after the takeover, as well as a trip to New York to visit his colleague Gutermann, where he also, Lefebvre also met a number of exponents of the Frankfurt School of Critical Theory. So, how does Lefebvre pose the problem? In his book on La conscience mystifiée from 1936, Lefebvre says this about the conjuncture in 1934, the middle of 1934 in France. Here's what he says with Gutermann. It is a fact that in mid-1934, all average French were massively demoralized, threatened, ruined, ridiculed. All certainties fell apart, all forms of confidence, including the trust in the uncertainty of uncertainties, freedom of thought, the democratic freedom without content. All these men are ready for the concrete liberation a revolution would bring. And perhaps also, unfortunately, the mystique and the brutal mythology of the fascists. So Gutermann and Lefebvre paint a picture of massive uncertainty, the possibilities of a real revolution, also opening up the possibility of its counterpoint all at the same time. This context, this situation, led Lefebvre to pose a number of important questions. What exactly is class consciousness? What may explain the success, in quotation marks, of Nazism and fascism among workers? And finally, what would Marx's theories of nation, nationalism, and ideology look like in response? Looking at those texts, one can see, in the first instance, a simple answer, a formula even. I'm trying to imitate Konishka here as a way of putting, as you noticed, because they have a habit of putting things down in that way. So fascism for Lefebvre and Gutermann really equals big capital plus ideology. Here is what Lefebvre says in his book about Hitler. The German community and the Hitlerites, German socialism, are simply and purely the theory and practice of sacrificing the individual on the altar of finance capital and its imperialist nationalism of conquest. Now, the emphasis on fascism and the capitalist is, of course, conventional at that time. What I think is more interesting for our purposes is the question of ideology. As Lefebvre himself said in 1988 in an interview with his biographer Vignes, I have often said that for me, the victory of fascism, of Hitlerism, was aesthetic. So this formula, in the first instance, gives us a picture of fascism as a paradoxically non-national, imperial phenomenon in the era of trusts, and an image of fascism as the last stage of mystification, as Lefebvre says with Gutermann in 1936. Mystification here in that book is defined as a false totalization of particular aspects of reality. So, what about mystification in more detail? Lefebvre and Gutermann identify, in a non-systematic way, I should say, a number of deeper sediments upon which mystification operates. The first one is the destructive violence of capitalism, as noted in the Great Depression and the fallout of the crisis of post-1929. Mystification also is built upon fetishism, the fetishism of commodities, but also the fetishism of the state, as important for Lefebvre. The second one being as important for Lefebvre as the first one. Lefebvre and Gutermann pay very little attention, however, to conjunctural factors, the relationship between the rise of fascism as a movement or regime, on the one hand, and particular developments in the balance of forces between various collective actors. As mystification, however, Lefebvre wants us to pay attention to particular inversions of reality brought about by this ideological phenomenon of mystification. And he makes a number of different examples. He points, for example, to mystification as the end point of, he points to fascism as a form of mystification that signals the end point of bourgeois culture, the moment where bourgeois culture needs to draw upon revolutionary aesthetic, that is to say, its counterpoint, in order to survive. Nationalism, too, for Lefebvre, represents an inversion of, in this case, national reality. I should say that when Lefebvre and Gutermann make reference to the notion of national realities, they have in mind Stalin's definition of the national question from 1935, which, for whatever its limitations, at least wants us to pay attention to a broad array of historical forces, not just particular select elements thereof. On that basis, Lefebvre proposes this very particular understanding of fascism not so much as a national phenomenon, but a non-national form of nationalism, an inversion of national realities. And here is what he says here with Gutermann in 1936. And despite their opposition to each other, as if by chance, all fascisms arrive at more or less identical mysticisms in similar, if variegated, barbarian vocabulary. Imperial fascism makes things uniform. So here we have a sense that fascism is a quintessentially international phenomenon. It's serialized almost as if it was subject to processes of commodification. Now, up to this point, Lefebvre operates with what others have called a negative conception of ideology. Right? Ideology as a form of false totalization, a particular way of distorting reality for particular purposes with particular effects. But in that book, Lefebvre also operates with a positive conception of ideology. asking, well, how is it possible that these forms of extreme mystification are produced? And how is it possible for them to be to resonate in people's everyday life? Right? So here, mystification involves both the process of producing ideology as well as its effects and realities in everyday life. Here is what it says. It's not enough to say that the thinkers of the bourgeoisie take their ideological material from traditional sources. One has to explain how these traditions have been conserved and why. How does ideological transposition work? How is it that it is not denounced by consciousness? How do the illusions, errors, and lies of professional thinkers find an audience? One needs to respond to these questions to explain mystification after having described it. The ideologues do not explain it because they need to be explained themselves. On that basis, Lefebvre-Gutermann proceed with a number of somewhat speculative but insightful commentary about, for example, why it might be that racism in the German context may resonate with workers and peasants. Why it might be that the revolutionary appeal of Nazism and fascism may resonate among workers. Here they propose, for example, that the fascist revolutionary discourse at the time presented a convenient shortcut. It presented the opportunity of its adherents to essentially get some form of instant gratification, to consume revolution rather than make it. He suggests. At the end, Lefebvre and Gutermann suggest also, therefore, that even though fascism and Nazism are built on violence and celebrate violence, are the cult of violence, the rule of fascism and Hitlerism cannot only be based on the basis of brute force and tyranny. It may even appear as a somewhat normalized form of everyday life. This insight, of course, is particularly important for all of us who are working on strategies to try to understand the normalization of the far right that we've seen in some parts of the world over the last generation. Now, given that Lefebvre was a member of the Communist Party in the 1930s, it is not surprising to see that, at an explicit level, Lefebvre refuses to make comments about the specific craziness of Communist Party strategy. Right? So there's no comment at that time about the Popular Front strategy, about how it developed and its limitations and grave consequences. Lefebvre does open to that kind of criticism after he leaves the Communist Party in 1958. I don't want to go into this now, but there are some interesting insights about his understanding of the Popular Front after the fact. In the 1930s, he does not comment on that reality, at least not to my knowledge. He may have in some other contexts, not in the text that I've looked at. His work in the 1930s, however, does provide us with a couple of important points which I think still stand today. One is the importance of ideological work for anti-fascist strategy. Here is what he says in his book on nationalism in a critique of his socialist and Marxist contemporaries. It appears that socialist and Marxist propaganda has been unilateral, even idealist in a sense. It often assumes that class consciousness is spontaneous, already fully formed, when the opposite is true. Class consciousness needs to be reconquered every day through an unceasing struggle against individualism and nationalism. So ideological work, a central upshot of Lefebvre's analysis in the 1930s. The other one has to do with his concrete conception of internationalism. André Dozel, who recently died, who wrote about these subjects, I think he's the only person that I know who's written about this work systematically a few years ago, suggests that there's another formula in Lefebvre's work in the 1930s. Nation and internationalism without nationalism. Lefebvre provides a double critique of abstract conceptions of internationalism together with a critique of abstract conceptions of nationalism. And that leads him to make a distinction between the nation or the national as a framework of action, on the one hand, and nationalism. This conception is not necessarily all that new, as we know from some work about Marx and Engels. The two of them also operated with conceptions of the national that are quite similar. Let me just highlight a quote here from that bigger quote. The nation cannot be an end itself. It is a given, a framework of action. The course of action should be determined by all concrete conditions. No nationalism on principle, no anti-nationalism on principle. One has to be wary of the mystifications of national sentiment. As other superstructures like law or culture, the nation as a framework of action can be given various inflections depending on the balance of forces, victories, and defeats. One thing to be said, and this is sort of the main conclusion here from our work, is, of course, the absence of another kind of set of national questions that were already quite prominent as Lefebvre was writing in the 1930s. His reference point was French and European. There is no discussion about other forms of national liberation struggle at that time. Even his biographical reflections from 1958-59 offer only the weakest self-critique about the limited geographical scope of Lefebvre's treatment of the national question in the 1930s. There is no word in his book in his books in the 1930s about the colonial realities of fascism. Fascism was much stronger on the ground among the French settler population in Algeria, for example, than in France. There is no word about the colonial aspects of anti-fascism supported by his own party, the Popular Front government, refusing to question colonialism, but offering only the slightest reforms to colonial regime, and indeed engaging in acts of repression against national liberation organizations. Also, no word in Lefebvre about attempts to forge an anti-fascist or an anti-colonial anti-fascist, an anti-fascist anti-colonialism. Popular Front being instrumental in the search of all sorts of intellectuals and organizers in France and in the colonies to develop a particular new kind of articulation that joins anti-colonialism with anti-fascism. Some of that critique Lefebvre could have and probably did know about, because it came from various sources at the margins of the French left, anarchists, Trotskyists, minority currents in the Socialist and Communist Party. He did not speak to those, as far as I know. But let me nonetheless leave you with a quote from the person who was perhaps most important at that time in French politics, Messali Hadj, one of the founders of Algerian nationalism, who was tried for his activities in 1937 under the Popular Front government, and said this in his defense: France cannot ignore the realities facing North Africans. Given the promises fascism dangles in front of their eyes, will the France of the Popular Front maintain its current policies? Will it continue to allow the Code de l'Indigénat, the special laws, to be used against the Algerian people? Will it refuse democratic liberties to the indigenous? It is time for the Popular Front government to gain the confidence and friendship of Muslim populations by taking an interest in their predicament, responding to their immediate demands, and embarking on a path of liberty and emancipation. We have no taste for fascism or imperialism. We love liberty, democracy, and we reject with all our strength servitude and oppression. In our two peoples' common interest, the politics of distrust, fear, and hesitation against us must cease and give way to a better era of agreement and collaboration. So, brief conclusion. How do we make sense of Lefebvre's work in the 1930s? I think it has two faces. At one level, it clearly contributes to the new national conventions of left politics in the middle of the 1930s, as Volikov, a historian of the Popular Front, pointed out. Within that context, there are also some important theoretical insights, in my view. His insight, Lefebvre's insight about fascist nationalism as a non-national phenomenon, his critique of mystification, remain, in my view, relevant points of discussion. The main critique that I'm leveling at his critique, of course, at his work, is one that should make us pause till today. What are the legacies of anti-fascism in the context of anti-colonial politics, and what are its relevance, points of relevance for current attempts to articulate an anti-fascist politics? It seems to me that that second question, the relationship between anti-fascism and anti-colonialism, would give us a few things to think about in relationship to current debates about left populism. Much of it are quite lazy, particularly on that question, but I'll leave that for more discussion.
Jill, please.
Okay, so I'm going to have something to say about the laziness of left populism. What I'm going to do is something that I really shouldn't be doing, but I'm going to do it anyway, which is in 20 minutes to try to give an outline of a book I'm working on. And what this means, of course, is that I'm going to have to do this in very broad brush strokes and sort of talk in shorthand a lot of the time. But the sort of point from which the book takes off is that the end of the Cold War was not just about the triumph of neoliberal capitalism and liberal democracy, but also the resurgence of racisms, nationalisms, and populist politics in many different regions of the world, widespread, albeit very uneven. And what this in turn has given rise to is what one might call a comparative imperative. And especially with the horrendous appearance of Trump, we get this tendency towards comparison of Trump with other right-wing populist dictators is widespread. But more generally, I think this imperative for comparison is extensive. But it seems to me that the problem is that what happens with many of these efforts at comparisons is that what they typically tend to do is to take pre-given national frameworks for granted, when in fact those very frameworks are part of the problem in the first place. So what this book is an effort to try to do is a simultaneously political and analytical project of understanding these processes in different regions of the world in relation to one another. And thinking about what is going on in different national settings, putting them into the same framework of analysis by seeing them as connected yet distinctively different nodes in globally interconnected historical geographies, and also as sites in the production of global processes rather than just recipients of them, and not just as separate national cases or as variants of a global process, but as sites in the production. Now, this framework initially grew out of my work in South Africa, and seeing sort of up front from the early to mid-2000s a massive upsurge in popular support for Jacob Zuma, in spite of a whole lot of things going on, including his being charged with rape. But what also became clear was that after Zuma was elected as president of the African National Congress in 2007, what we saw all over South Africa was the outbreak of horrendous xenophobic attacks. And what became clear was what we urgently needed to try to understand what was going on was serious attention to nationalism, which was startlingly missing from the vast majority of left analyses that were very much focused on neoliberalism and the shift from race to class apartheid. And in sort of trying to grapple with nationalism, what I was very much drawn to was the work of a group of Indian scholars very much concerned with the rise of Hindutva, with extreme right-wing Hindu nationalism. And several were very important to me. Ejaz Ahmed, Himani Banerjee, Manu Goswami, and Sumit and Tanaka Sarkar. And what they all did was, in different but complementary ways, really try to think about how do we understand the coincidence of this massive upsurge of extreme right nationalism coinciding with the Indian National Congress ushering in neoliberal capitalism in the early 1990s. And what was also sort of so compelling about that was parallel processes that had gone on in South Africa since the early 90s. And then, of course, in 2014, with the victory of Modi, I became really very focused on trying to understand these forces in India and South Africa in relation to one another. And what happened as I tried to engage these, to understand what was going on in the early 90s, immediately after the Cold War in both India and South Africa, and subsequent developments in different directions, I was increasingly thrust back into the past, into earlier conjunctures. And that is where this idea of conjunctural comparison actually came from. And I remember the first time I tried it out was in 2015 at the geography meetings on a panel that the three of us organized. We've been doing this thing for a while. And part of what I found really important and compelling about this idea of conjunctural comparison, of going back into the past to produce a different understanding of the past, to travel back into the present, was that it also provided a way of, the spatio-historical approach provided a way of understanding race, ethnicity, gender, sexuality, class, religion as deeply, inseparably, and actively constitutive of both class processes and nationalisms. Now, I was just sitting down late in 2016 to try to write a book on all of this when Trumpism happened. And, Trumpism really was, it was a punch in the gut. It was a major wake-up call. And what was really, there were three aspects of the debates that immediately erupted around Trumpism that I found really striking. The one was a widespread presumption and very parochial presumption of American exceptionalism. The second was, both the left and the liberal right, a tendency to cast debate in terms of race versus class, which went back to old South African debates from the 60s and 70s. And then the third was the almost total absence of attention to nationalism in all of this. And my being drawn into focusing on Trumpism was also very much driven by the fact that Berkeley in the spring of 2017 was sort of the ground zero of neo-fascist forces, both on campus and in parks and so forth, where there were, you know, these stormtroopers would come in, and some of the people sitting in this room were very much part of all of that. And it was also the reaction. You know, and also, I was also teaching a big undergraduate course, and it was very clear that students were hungry for analyses. There were lots of debates going on campus. But what was actually very influential for me was a reading group at least one person in this room was there with some of its comrades. But a wonderful reading group of undergraduates and graduate students, and we were reading about populism, fascism, nationalism, and constantly going back and forth between what was in fact going on. So that what I initially tried to do was to pose a question and to try to think about how, when we think about Trumpism from the perspective, from a non-Western perspective, especially from India, South Africa, how does this, how might this provide not only different insights, but also, I argue, poses a different kind of question. That especially from the viewpoint of India and South Africa, the question was not so much what explains Trumpism, but rather, why did it take so long for a right-wing demagogic figure like Trump to ascend to power, given the long, very long histories of racism, populism, populist, right-wing populist politics, white nationalisms, given the searing inequalities, the material inequalities in the US, and thirdly, given the Democratic Party's abandonment of the working class. And what I first, the first sort of round, my first crack at this, what I tried to do was use the idea of simultaneous processes of denationalization and renationalization since the end of the Cold War that I used first to think about South Africa and then India in relation to the US. But as I thought more about this, I've actually realized that what I need is a different kind of, a rather different kind of framework. So just very quickly, what I'm gonna do is sort of outline this framework. And it's an argument that if we're going to understand these processes, that we have to think about forces operating, first of all, at the global conjunctural level. And I'll say more about what I mean about this in a minute. Secondly, the forces operating in the realms of everyday life, very much along the lines that both Kanishka and Stefan have written about, and Kanishka's work on Lefebvre is especially illuminating on the questions of everyday life. And then practices, processes, projects of bourgeois hegemony that mediate between the global conjunctural levels and everyday life. And obviously there are parallels here with the first three levels in the urban revolution, where the urban is the mediating level. But I think for purposes of trying to understand the conditions in which we find ourselves, that thinking about hegemony is really important. How am I doing for time?
A few minutes more.
Okay, all right. So I'm gonna move super fast from here on. So, but I think the whole question of how we think about nationalism as operating at all three levels is really crucial. And here I just want to give you a short quote from Ijaz Ahmed that I think actually resonates with what both Kanishka and Stefan were talking about in interesting ways. This is from an article called Fascism and National Culture, Reading Gramsci in the Days of Hindutva, that he wrote immediately after the massacre of Muslims in 1992. And he says, questions of the nation is not a thing which once made simply endures. Nation, like class, is a process which is made and remade a thousand times over. And more than a process, nation is a terrain of struggle which condenses all social struggles so that every organized force in society attempts to endow it with specific meanings and attributes. And what I want to do now is just, since I've got 5 minutes.
Maximum, yeah.
Just lay out the chapters. And I'll just zip very quickly in a minute through how this, really all I can do is work through the steps through which I'm trying to develop the argument. But really importantly, I think I'll start with what I see as the political stakes of a global conjunctural frame of analysis. And I think what's really important here is that in Marxist theory, conjunctural analysis is inherently political. But how we actually theorize conjunctures, I think, is crucial. And there's a difference here between an Althusserian and a Gramscian understanding of conjunctures. And I think some of this work comes out very interestingly in the historical materialism article by Koivisto and Latinen. But I think also what's crucial is the importance of thinking conjunctures in a specifically spatial historical frame. And this is something Stefan and I have written about, which is also where a sort of conjunctural comparative approach links directly with a Gramscian understanding of politics as translation. And the whole question of translation, I think, becomes important here. So a second really important piece of the political stakes turns around the whole question of this constitutive force of race, gender, sexuality, caste, religion, as constitutive of both class and class processes and nationalism. Because any kind of coalitional politics obviously has to engage these issues. But third turns around populism and my very strong antagonism towards left populism in general and Chantal Mouffe's version of left populism in particular. And I'm not going to go into detail in this except to say that it seems to me that, Mona Goswami put it very neatly at a symposium that Kanishka and I were part of, where she said that left populism is socialism on the cheap. It seems to me there are two very important recent texts that deal with with Marxist analyses of populism that I found very stimulating. One by Michael Gray, in Historical Materialism, one by Panagiotis Soteris. But it seems to me that taken together, what they're both talking about is the imperative for the problem with left populism is that it's not just about a great man or woman able to sort of string together chains of equivalences of different grievances or demands, but the kind of deep organizing through which more critical, coherent understandings might emerge. And that this is where a global conjunctural framework really, I think, moves us there. Now, I do not, in fact, as I knew I wouldn't, have time to talk through the framework, but if anybody wants to ask questions. But just let me finish up by saying, just let me read you just a one-liner. That we're developing these arguments in relation, well, first of all, that how we think about imperialism is crucial, and the thing about the US has forced me to go back and rethink questions of imperialism along these lines. The argument is that the new imperialism was not just about neoliberalism, it was about the way in which the relationship of the US to different regions of the world dramatically changed in the 1980s. And that what's interesting about India and South Africa is they don't fit this pattern, but they let us see what I call Cold War era projects unraveling. And it's the unraveling of these Cold War era projects that's crucial to understanding what unfolded in the period after the Cold War. And from this, to get back to the why did it take so long question, the argument I want to make is that what a conjunctural comparative framework operating at these three different levels simultaneously lets us see is that Trump-Bannonism is not an aberration, but a live though latent possibility that required a particular conjuncture of forces in order to burst forth. But it also lets us see the specific ways in which Trumpianism is riddled with contradictions in ways that I think hold open the possibility for more critical, coherent understanding. Thank you.